Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right, well, her latest book is called Bones of Belonging. Anahi Dashgard joins me on the show to talk about it. Welcome.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Now, this is a follow-up to Breaking the Ocean, and that one was a memoir, and this is more a collection of essays. And I'm curious about kind of the pathway from that first book to this one. When you put the last, you know, period on Breaking the Ocean, did you have a sense there was another book coming?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. I feel like I think of Ed Sheeran, who said from the beginning, I know there's four albums and these are the names. With writing, it feels similar for me that I feel like there's four books and the names are there for all of them. So I did know there would be another book. And I did early on have a sense that it would be a collection of like essay stories. And I knew, and then, you know, the stories took shape and the theme kind of took shape. And, you know, I think I wrote at the beginning, the preface of the book that I started at the beginning of COVID and ended just when we were coming out. That was not planned. Mm-hmm. So the arc of the stories reflecting on different relationships of belonging, what it means to belong, what happens when it's absent, how do we recreate it for ourselves and for others, you know, happened in this time where connection was, I think, what we were all yearning and searching for. And so yeah, I knew it would be a collection, but I didn't know the context we entered really set the stage, as it were.
So the title Bones of Belonging was there beforehand, though?
Yeah, early on. Yeah. Before I started writing, I think I knew that part of the title. Yeah.
So very often, like, well, not very often, but sometimes the title suggests kind of the scope of the project, and sometimes the project then kind of dictates what it should be called. Like, you wanted to look at belonging and at the body as kind of your central crises?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So, I mean, I think it's relevant. So I'll mention it in my quote unquote day job, because no writer is living just writing these days unless they're very lucky. My day job is running a racial justice consulting company. And in my work, I feel like my work life and my writing life are very parallel tracks. And what I see in my work life when I'm teaching or decoding inclusion or equity or diversity for organizational leaders is people sort of pick up the words, but they don't really understand what they mean. They don't know how to translate equity or inclusion into relationship. What is the impact when people don't have access to feeling like they can be themselves in their place of work or their community, when they can take risks to speak up, or when they do speak up and they're not listened to like other people are of different identities? Like, what's the impact of that? And I felt like Breaking the Ocean was very intimate. It was my personal story. I wanted Bones of Belonging to help people decode this increasingly polarized conversation around race and racial justice. And so it works on a couple of levels. I mean, I think anyone that struggles to feel a sense of belonging can relate. And also, I think that it really does help people locate themselves in this conversation around racial justice to be able to read, because each of the main essays is interwoven with small vignettes. So to be able to read one of these pieces and go, oh, I can relate to this moment. Oh, I get it. I didn't quite understand what micro inequity, what the impact was of that. I get it a little bit more now. And lastly, I'll say that I think people are short of time, and I really like books that I can pick up at any time of the day and just read a piece and feel complete and like I got something, that it was rich, and then put it down and pick it up again. And so I wanted, you know, Bones of Belonging to be like that, a book that can be read over and go on a journey with somebody over a span of time and be picked up and put down. Yeah, that's...
Yeah, you write in the preface, you know, this could be read in any order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm curious about, you know, the creation of the book then, and how you shape something where you're thinking about it being parsed out or taken selectively or piece by piece, or in some way, not the way that it is from, you know, page one through, mm-hmm. through that final page. Like how do you decide on a flow when mm-hmm. you're also thinking about a reader who just won't go with that flow?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, it's both and. So there's definitely a coherency. You know, the title came actually from an image of the human skeleton. And in the human skeleton, like what holds us up, you know, from birth to death and allows us to move and, you know, is what regenerates and holds all kinds of memory, are smaller, larger connecting bones. And so I had this vision of, you know, 10 essays that would be the anchors, and then the smaller vignettes that would weave through. And so there is a coherency, I guess, if you go from beginning to end. And also, I think you can just jump into any one of the parts, and it kind of pulls out a particular theme that goes a little bit deeper into a certain aspect or relationship to belonging. So for example, one of the chapters is on power. You know, we can't talk about belonging without really tackling what does power mean. There's more than one source of power. Race is one, gender, religion, all of those systemic identities are a big part of what it means to have more or less power. But there's many other things that give people more or less power or influence, like personality traits and social capital and even physical aspect like beauty or, you know, physical height. And so, you know, you can pick up the book and just there's an essay kind of walking through that and smaller pieces that so it's both and it can be read coherently. And it's there's a journey to that. But I know people have just picked up and read a couple pieces here and there and also been quite, you know, gotten something from it, I think.
Right. Now, you mentioned your day job and that, you know, your writing and your day job kind of run in parallel tracks, but you do draw on experiences from within, you know, sessions for your day job for some of these essays.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, in those moments, like, are you recording all of your presentations so that you have kind of an accurate summation of what happened? Or is it something where if a specific incident happens, you then go write it down for future use?
No, I don't record. I mean, we do record, but for participants' use, I don't think I've gone back and listened to any of the sessions. It's twofold. One, if I'm working out a particular theme, I will think sort of cognitively about what stories might fit, but then also let it gestate over time and see what stories will intuitively pop up. The other way of working is sometimes there'll be a story that very strongly is there in a session, or I know that that was a powerful moment, and I'll jot it down into my writing notebook. And because the moment has emotional impact, I remember the details of it. Sometimes I'll just jot down some lines of dialogue if I want to remember more concretely what was said. And I tend, you know, I'm not so interested in, sometimes the actual dialogue is, you know, is the most powerful, but sometimes I'll, you know, write to the impact of that moment. So I'll take, you know, what happened and amalgamate three or four moments or many more that speak to this theme and kind of like choose the, like, what is usually what happens? What's the pattern here? Writing to that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause I'm thinking of one in particular. You are speaking in front of a group of custodial staff for a school division. Mm-hmm. And a fellow who is a veteran stands up and you talk about, you know, he says something particularly blatantly racist, and then you thank him for it because it allows you to kind of like address it directly. Mm-hmm. Around the notions of equal opportunity and this being what you say is a relay race where each group concentrates on running as fast as they can in a forward direction and not necessarily noticing the hurdles facing those in the lanes beside them.
Mm-hmm.
Is this like kind of like when that happened in that presentation, it's like, exactly, I need to write this up.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what had happened in that situation. Yeah. And yes, it was really powerful and very rare because, like I say in the essay, most of the time, especially around this topic, people are really guarded to share what they really think and feel, which I think is part of the reason we're in such a moment of extreme polarization around these issues, is because people feel so uncomfortable having these conversations. I think we just need a lot more spaces where the conversation can happen and we humanize each other. We can disagree, but we can still humanize the other side, see what, you know, is good in them. And in this particular story, here's somebody that has faced class oppression, but just because one faces one set of obstacles because of their identity in one part of their lives doesn't mean that they automatically understand what racial oppression looks like or gender oppression. And in fact, I'd say the opposite is true, that when we experience one form of oppression, it can actually make it harder for us to be open to other forms. It's almost like I need to make sure my story is heard before I can acknowledge anyone else's. And, you know, I think about the province of Quebec and how hard it is to address Indigenous, anti-Indigenous racism, anti-Black racism, immigrant rights, because the narrative is so dominantly about French minority rights, right? As one example, but there's so many, right? And in this story, this man, and it's so hard to kind of see what other groups are facing.
That it's like a calcification that comes from like hardening based on protecting the one thing you have.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And I think that this goes back to, Michael, some studies say, and I believe this, that belonging is more primal a need, or as primal as I need for food, water, shelter, because, you know, we're tribal beings. When we weren't part of the community, it felt like death, because it often meant death, right? That was that hard to survive on one's own. And I think that we may have evolved cognitively, but our reptilian brain still kind of runs a lot of the show. And so I think, you know, our need to belong, to have our story be recognized, because when our story is recognized, when our story is visible, we feel safer, because it means that we will then be taken into account when decisions are made. And this is the thing about also why I had a fire in my belly to write this book, is that, you know, in Canada, we talk about multiculturalism and our strong democracy. Well, guess what? No, a democracy is only as strong as as the range of stories that are visible, reflecting the people in that country. And in Canada, it's only in the last 5 years that we've really been publishing stories of Black, Indigenous people of color. And it's still a struggle, speaking as the BIPOC author, to get our story or stories out there. And so, yeah, I think it's just really important, because when we feel someone's story, I'm saying this in a different way, I've already said this, but when I really get your story in my gut, I won't forget it. And I'm more likely to stand up for you when I'm voting, when I'm talking to my neighbor, when I'm deciding, I think you play a part in my decision making. And that's what strengthens our democracy, when we take each other into account.
So for you, then, the experience has been, if you learn to empathize with someone else and understand kind of like the gaps between your experience and theirs, you're more likely to take that into account in terms of future decision making?
Absolutely. I've read stories about trans folks, and it's part of my work as well, but how would I put it? It's taken me from being an ally at the cognitive level to, yeah, this is what equity looks like, and here's how I use different language, and, you know, these are important policies to support trans-identified kids, to, like, I'm in this because I get it. I understand the impact, and I'm going to stand for this. And it's a different kind of motivation to stand up for the rights of trans-identified individuals. So, yeah, I think that empathy is our superpower when it comes to creating equitable, accessible, democratic spaces.
There's another instance in the book. I was just kind of reviewing my notes in terms of, you know, places that you drew from your work that you'd done in a session with someone, and you're with a group of lawyers, and one of the lawyers says, you know, we don't need to agree on racism to do something about it.
Yes.
And like, I'm still puzzling over what exactly they meant by it, because it's like, if you don't except that it's a problem, how can you try to address a problem? Like, what needs solving if you're not saying it's a problem?
That's exactly it, Michael. And I kid you not, this is one of the top legal firms in North America, and this is their executive team. And that was an exact line, and there were nods of agreement. I thought the same thing. I thought, but you're lawyers, like, your whole professional identity is based on naming things clearly and articulating the patterns so you can interrupt it. It was really interesting. And I think that, you know, I will say there's a little bit of truth in that statement. Like, there are things that we can do practically without understanding what discrimination looks like and how it plays out. But I'd say leadership teams kind of have a responsibility to go through the learning. And, I just thought, what is the avoidance here? Because to me, that's about some emotional block that's coming up in that particular, you know.
Like an unwillingness to be empathetic?
Yeah. I think that the group was, I think it was, there was some, they, I think they, there was a desire to sort of push things ahead. And I think that some of the senior leadership was resistant. So I think, and in part, it was a statement to, well, we can do some things, right? Like, we don't have to agree this is an issue fully. We can just do some things, maybe pressure to just show they were doing something in their policies. So to just get some moving forward. But to your question, lack of empathy. Yeah. And I think that lack of empathy goes back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago, that I feel like I'm not willing to give up my own story because I don't feel like my story, I don't feel validated. So I'm not going to stretch to acknowledge other people might face barriers. And there's a lot of people still that are really wedded to this belief in meritocracy, that it's just innate intelligence and talent that leads to people's success, which is so not the case, right? Sorry about
Right.
that.
Oh yeah,
Sorry.
no. Yeah, it's something that it seems because you do write in kind of your letter to your father about, you know, like the experience of him as a, you know, like the person who made the move to Canada. You're the person who came with him, right? Like it wasn't necessarily your choice to do it, and your two experiences were different, and then looking at your children's experiences and sort of the like willingness of each generation to kind of like put up with a certain level of things diminishes because you see kind of what that prior generation went through and the like sublimation of self that it involved.
Yeah, and also because I, like many immigrant kids, came, before I was of age. So I grew up with my primary identity as Canadian. And I expected the rights and opportunities that come with every, other Canadian-born person. And although the racism I experienced when we first moved when I was younger was extreme, as an adult, it is not that overt, which I feel grateful for, because I have a certain amount of class privilege. Like I mostly am working in professional circles at this point in my life. But, for me at this point, the discrimination is more subtle. It's being underestimated. It's if I show up in a space with a white colleague, not even though there might be an employee, 95% of the time people will go and greet my white employee. It's having to work harder to get my manuscript out there as a BIPOC author. It's, sometimes like on a call, especially with white male CEOs, like just I can just see, I just know it would be different if I was a different gender and racial type. And so it's all those subtle ways in which I still every day have to put more effort fighting to claim my space in this country that I've moved to, that I don't think people that are white have to do in the same way.
Yeah, you kind of touch on that in that the piece about being like a bad kind of immigrant, and like the go along to get along is quote unquote the good immigrant, and then being angry and pushing back against those kinds of like being on that call with the white CEO is the bad kind of immigrant, but that anger drives you because you see that that's the emotion that can change things.
Yeah, and I think part of that essay was also reflecting on the anger was useful and it was necessary for me to start to see the discriminatory patterns and to decouple them from my own lack. Because for so long I thought it was just because I needed to work harder. I wasn't as articulate. I didn't know as much. Whereas at this point I'm like, I walk into most rooms and I teaching no more than most people sitting there, which isn't, like I feel that that is true. And, but reactive anger is not helpful. And it actually can be, it's not only harmful in relationship, but it also is harmful to self. And that kind of reactive anger is not where I spend much time anymore. If I feel anger, I will work it through. So I get really clear and the anger might be there and I might kind of need to draw a boundary or advocate for something, but it's not lashing out in the same way that I think it came out in an earlier part of my life. Does that make sense?
Right, because you talk about your own experiences with kind of like self-harm and you know eating disorders and stuff that like you maybe took that anger and put it into yourself in a way that was not that was harmful to you and that you've reconciled with like anger is an emotion all of us feel for different reasons, but what we do with that anger I think can be good for us or bad for us in some way. It's like there's always going to be something that makes people angry, but how they process that anger in the way that anyone processes any feeling, right? I mean, like chasing joy all the time, people can become,
Yeah.
there's like addictive behavior when it comes to that.
Yeah, it's kind of like diesel fuel. If we use it properly, it can kind of give more mileage. But if we don't and like take a match to it, it can cause you blow the whole vehicle up.
It's explosive, right? In the same way anger can be explosive. Yeah.
Yeah, I do think a lot of what allows us to be effective in changing systems is actually becoming more emotionally intelligent, right? So that the more I can uncouple what I'm feeling and experiencing from what is actually happening, like the more I can see this situation clearly, the more chance I have to actually choose the best words or the best option or direction to go in that moment. And it's taken a lot of time in my own personal journey to A, recognize the different emotions and to separate, because it felt like a big, if I did feel anything, it felt like a big mush ball and I couldn't like have named what the different feelings were. So that was stage one. And then stage two was working, finding different ways, therapy and body work and meditation to not get swallowed into the emotion, but to kind of ride the wave, as some people put it. And at this point, to use those emotions as information about what might be happening for me, but what also might those be informing about what's happening in the space. And then using that along with, analysis and strategic knowledge to make the best choice. But I think that developing emotional intelligence is just really important for having systems impact, for changing things that are unfair in the world, especially racial justice, because it's so tender a spot in society these days. So even more emotional intelligence is needed.
Has being a parent impacted that process for you at all as well? Like in terms of seeing and managing another person's emotions, and particularly a person you're essentially responsible for?
Yeah, I mean, Michael, I know you're a parent because you mentioned it earlier. Like it's parenting is like, I don't feel anyone put it this clearly to me, but just feels like it's the unavoidable, being pushed into the fire. Not like just over and over and over again. And you either burn or you alchemize. So yeah, I feel like I've had being a parent, I was already on the path to doing, I would say developing my own self-awareness and identifying emotional patterns that were not healthy or not helping my relationships or work, perhaps in some ways. And then it catalyzed that process because all of a sudden everything just becomes more intensified. And things like my need for control, how quickly I would feel sort of inner like rage sometimes if things weren't going the way I thought they should. What is that about? And so yeah, I'd say that, and I continue to do work. So yeah, I think it's been a really powerful laboratory.
And you do write about your son, protecting your name out in public, that, making sure that you don't shorten it to Anna, that like people recognize you as you.
It's very sweet. Because we talk with our children about these, what does belonging mean and different identities? What does it mean to be Black and brown? Because we identify as a brown family, and names, and why are names important? And maybe I'll just close with reading this little thing because it's short.
Please
Do we
do.
have time?
Yeah,
Okay.
yeah.
It's called Names. It's a furnace of a day, thanks to climate change and this being the peak of summer weather. To cool off, the four of us head over to the local outdoor pool to go swimming. We have to check in at reception, a couple of makeshift folding tables first. When we finally reach the front of the line, the teenage attendant asks, names in a bored monotone voice, with pen poised to record them on the sheet in front of them. I suddenly get an image of immigration lines at ports of entry into this country about 100 years ago. I always feel a slight tightening inside whenever I'm asked for my name. Still. My son Coda, 4 years old, declares in a trying to be helpful and sound like an adult tone of voice, my mama's name is Anahid. I know it sounds kind of weird, but that's really her name. I laugh while inwardly cringing from the mouth of babes. Not even my own son is exempt from the learned discomfort with names like mine, cultures like mine, ancestry like mine. Anahit is such a common name in Iran, the Middle East, and beyond, but here it bears a stamp of foreigner, outsider, someone to be wary of. We enter the change room, and the intensive gymnastics of getting swimsuits onto two hyperactive children quickly chases any memory of my own name right out of my head. Submerging myself into the cool waters of the pool is a welcome relief. I talked to my son later that night. That hurt me a little bit when you said my name was weird. What's different about my name versus Sally or Rachel? It sounds different, he replies. But for who? I ask. I used to go by Anna, but then I realize my real name comes from a place where it represents water and stars, the name of a goddess, a powerful name people used to worship and still do. It was only when I moved here, Baba, that people bullied and teased me about it. He squeezes my hand and I continue gently. People still get it wrong most of the time, but that's okay because now I choose to use it. I'd like you to use it as well. Okay, Mama, he nods, staring at me solemnly, his brown eyes wide and rounded in his small face. Thanks, Baba, I whisper. Time for some hugging. A year later, I arrive to pick up Coda from a play date, and his friend's mother comes out to greet me. Oh, Anahid, she says, I have... She doesn't get any further because Coda comes out and carefully, like, yet confidently interrupts her. Actually, my mom's name is pronounced Ah-Nahid. I feel a little embarrassed, but also proud. He has overcome his default absorption of the norms around him because of the desire to do better by his mama. As we walk home together, I squeeze his hand in mine, realizing I feel more than just pride or momentary self-consciousness. I feel loved. Sometimes at busy coffee counters, I will still shorten my name to Anna, just once in a while when the line is long and my time is short. If Coda is with me, though, I can't get away with it. Your name is Anahid, he'll admonish and then loudly correct the barista as well. He has become my name guard, on the lookout for occasions where I might be slighted or minimized through the mispronunciation of my birth title. I relish how my child self is now protected by my own child, his generation learning from and correcting the erasure my mind faced. Names are the first signal as to whether and how much we are welcomed anywhere. My son reminds me that a key measure of belonging will be when all names matter.
Well, that is a perfect little summary of what you can expect from the rest of Bones of Belonging. Anahid, thanks very much for joining me on the program, and congratulations on the release of this book. And obviously, you have two more book titles, so we got two more books coming down the
Right. A pleasure, Michael. Thank you so much for having me.